My name's Mike Beckerle. I work for Trasis Technology, and I'm here today to tell you about the Dataform Description Language and the Apache Daffodil Incubator Project, which is its implementation. I want to remind you that, in case you don't know about it, there is a gnarly data boff tonight, Birds of a Feather at 1900 up on the P floor, and we will attempt to take your gnarly data and turn it into a Daffodil schema so it can be parsed easily, interactively. Here with me today, Steve Lawrence, also one of the committers on the Apache Daffodil project, and he'll be helping me. Hopefully people will bring some interesting data, and there is a prize for the gnarliest data format. So, my goal is today is to build community around Apache Daffodil, recruit developers, find additional mentors, encourage integration of Daffodil into Apache projects that intake and export data. And in order to do that, I have to convince you that DFDL Daffodil solves an important problem and that it is technology that would be fun to work on. So in order to do that, I am going to give some motivation about the data format problem, DFDL, the language, the standards, Daffodil, why that's important. I'll talk about DFDL schemas, which are what are the descriptions of the formats and where one would get one, what's out there. And then I'll tell you about the technology, DFDL itself, and mostly about Daffodil, the software, the code base, details about it, its status. And I am going to delve into an interesting little technical detail just to convince you that there's some cool stuff going on inside the software that you might want to work on or you might find interesting. All right, with that, I will get right into it. So why do we need this data format description language? And the answer is because there's hundreds of them already, so we got to have one more, right? No, it's because there's hundreds of them, and they come into existence continually. Every enterprise software company or startup that builds a piece of software that processes data analytically or a database or to do data cleansing, whatever it is for, if it got to bring in data, they got to figure out, oh, well, how are we going to describe, I mean, not all the data is sitting there in XML or JSON or something. There's lots and lots of data formats in the world that are in heavy use. And so everything in the world that processes data is inventing these things all the time. And if you worked for a big software company like I have, several of them in the past, I mean, within IBM, there's 10 or 20 data format description languages because every company they've acquired had one. And these things live on. And they're, in general, these things are either proprietary or ad hoc. They're not standards or anything like that. They're just aspects of a product. They, generally speaking, are incompatible with each other. And that's true even across products of the same company. And I haven't even got into the Apache projects here because there's tons of them that take in data and that have had to try and solve this problem in their various ways. So, whoops, I went the wrong direction. Bear with me. That arrow, thank you. So given that you got hundreds of data format description systems, that means the investment is basically spread too thin on this problem. It means you got tools for helping people create a format description for their data format are really inadequate. The products are not comprehensive enough in this area. It's a hard problem. And the difficulty of it is really grossly underestimated. And so if you have some company that wants to build some great data dashboard or database or data analytics system, you really don't want to invest in a comprehensive solution to this problem. It's probably harder than the problem you set out to solve to begin with. Some of the products are simply too slow. There's all the usual problems of customer lock-in because it's particular to a specific package. And most of these things aren't libraries. They're not something you can take and package into something else. They're part of a product, and you use it as part of the way you use that product. So this is the kind of a problem that, for DFDL also is needed because there's some interesting new use cases. When I've been working in data processing and analytics systems and so forth for much of my career, and when I started working on DFDL full time, the use case that was paying for me to work on it is actually cybersecurity, which was interesting to me. And it's about normalization of data. If you have a piece of data, we all know what firewalls are. We all know what a blacklist and a whitelist is. You want to allow, if you have a whitelist, you're going to allow certain kinds of data to go across your firewall. Well, just because it says it's a JPEG doesn't mean it is a JPEG. But if you rip it to its atomic pieces and put it back together according to that specification, now you have a pretty good idea that it really is a JPEG at that point. So that's being used to remove a large class of data-borne threats as data moves from lower security environments to higher security environments. You're basically reducing the attack surface that data can use to compromise software by insisting that the data truly obeys its specification. There's a bunch of other kinds of interesting use cases these days. There's mandates showing up in government for data publishing, for example. Modernizing of data systems generally is not as easy as we updated the whole thing. Usually there's a coexistence when you have to interact with legacy systems. And finally, there's a skills leverage issue here, which is there's a lot of developers now in the internet era who are really good with dealing with XML and JSON problems. And the data format skills needed to deal with legacy data, some of these military data formats that date from the 70s but are in broad use still today, all the world of COBOL and financial services data formats, these things aren't going away, but the skills surrounding them are becoming more rare. And so DFDL has an important role to play in amplifying people's skills so that they can get past these legacy data problems easily. So how do you solve this problem, though? There's hundreds of these things in the marketplace. You know, it's one of these problems which, for our industry, I don't know how you solve this without an organization like the Apache Software Foundation. There's two parts to how we're setting out to solve this problem. One is an open standard for the data format description language, the language itself that you write a schema in to describe that. And then you need an open, high-quality, open-source library that implements that, that has the characteristics of an Apache community around it, a supporting community of developers. My company, Traces, we're interested in providing commercial support for this for people who need help, and also training on DFDL and things of that sort. The DFDL language is being standardized through an organization called the Open Grid Forum. I was happy to find out this week that OpenStack also implements an important specification coming from the Open Grid Forum, so we're not the only one. And they require multiple implementations that interoperate. So you can't promote a standard if you just do the open source implementation. And so that's quite interesting. There are actually commercial implementations of DFDL that already exist today. So in order to have an open standard, you have to have some long-term sponsorship. IBM has their own DFDL implementations and has had a long-term commitment to DFDL. I'll have a quick mention of their product later just to contrast it with Apache Daffodil. The work that I've been doing on Daffodil has been sponsored by the U.S. Department of Defense and Canada Department of National Defense, again, around this cybersecurity topic. But also, in general, the Departments of Defense are, like many large organizations with lots of computers around, have this legacy data problem up, down, and sideways. So this problem applies very generally there. The other thing you need in order to get the ball off the ground is you need some DFDL schemas for important data formats so that people can get the ball rolling, have some patterns to follow when they implement new schemas. So let me go on to the next slide here. So let me tell you about DFDL, and I'm going to have about a six-slide quick introduction to DFDL, and I think everybody here will get it You won't be able to walk out of here and write your own DFDL schemas, but you'll understand what it is and what it's for. It comes from the Open Grid Forum. Work on this began, I began working on it at the first meeting in 2001. If you can believe, it's 17 years now I've been working on this. It's kind of hard for me to believe. But work really didn't, not much happened until about 2008. It really accelerated. There are significant contributors to this language standard from the UK, from Canada, from the USA, and now several more places internationally. The first implementation of DFDL, it was still a draft in formulation at the time, was in November 2011. It's a business-oriented subset of the DFDL language. The DFDL specification is, version one of it came out officially in September 2014. It's quite thick. If you printed it, you'd get 200 pages, or 200 plus, actually. I haven't counted recently, but it is a specification that allows conforming subsets. So the required core you have to implement in order to say you've implemented DFDL is quite small. Daffodil is implementing a quite large chunk of it. There's just a few things that we're leaving out for the moment. We do hope to implement all of it at some point. It is current status of the DFDL language standard is it's a proposed recommendation. And the gateway between that and a full recommendation is a two implementation interoperability statement. You have to be able to show there's two implementations of the standard and they interoperate in order to graduate and become a full recommendation. We're hoping to do that sometime in the next year. That's my goal. The DFDL workgroup is active. Mostly what the DFDL workgroup does on our semi-weekly calls is work on clarifications and errata to the spec as we're doing implementation. We find things that aren't clear or that are incorrect and we fix them. So as a reminder, data format description language is not a data format. It's a way of describing data formats. The way we came up with DFDL was basically by the people working on the committee represented a lot of experience with a lot of data integration and data products in the marketplace, and we essentially took a union of all their capabilities and standardized it. This is a good way to do a standard. You don't want to be too creative when you're trying to create something and have it be a standard. You mostly want to generalize or improve from examples of things. But there were a few problems in the world of data format description that required some innovation because things weren't, in this sphere of products, there were just some problems that weren't being solved adequately. And they include the ability to compute elements with expressions. I'll be digging into that a little bit so you'll see what I mean. An expression language is part of DFDL for that reason. A bunch of things about bit order and various things like that were not broadly enough provided in the commercial world, although there were some military systems that did that. So we brought those capabilities into the DFDL language. The core concepts in DFDL are we are going to leverage the XML schema language, XSDL. That's basically being used as a grammar scaffolding to describe the logical structure of the physical data that you're trying to describe. We're not using every single thing in XML schema. We're using a subset of the features of it. But one of the things that XML schema does is it provides a standard way to annotate a schema. So you're describing a logical structure and the pieces and parts of something, and there's actually a standard way to enhance that with additional information. Now, because developers have a love-hate relationship with XML, I know I do, the Daffodil schema language is based on XML schema, but the info set that you create when you use DFDL does not have to be XML. You can use XML, you can use JSON, you can operate directly in the info set from an API, etc. So the schema language is XML schema. That doesn't mean you're stuck in the world of XML if you were one of the people in the hate category about XML. All right, now I'm going to give you an actual example of a DFDL schema so that you get what I'm talking about here. So here's a little piece of data. This is text data. Ignore the coloring for a moment. That's just so that for exposition purposes here. But This has got two fields in it. They're both numeric. One is 5 and the other is -7.1E8. So an integer and a floating point number. And there's this labeling around them, R limit and RPNGX. This is an ASCII text integer. That's an ASCII text floating point. There's an initiator or a tag for R limit there and another tag for RPNGX. And they're separated with a semicolon. Those things are in Daffodil. Those things are initiators or tags, terminators, separators. Those things are what we call delimiters in general, and I think that's not an uncommon term. So we want to develop a DFDL schema so we can parse this data. We start out. This is what an XML schema looks like. If you haven't seen one, this is a complex type. It's a sequence of two values, two elements. The first one I'm going to call rlim, the second one I'm calling rpng. Those are the logical elements that make up this physical piece of data. And then I'm going to annotate it. So at the top is a block annotation, and the blue part is boilerplate, the black part is what matters. The black part is saying that the format is textual. It's got standard text numbers, meaning the standard floating point notation and decimal points, things of that sort. Encoding is ASCII, the length kind is delimited. There's a bunch of additional properties that would normally be in the boilerplate there that I haven't included. But then down here on the structure of the actual schema, the black text is the annotations that are placed directly on here that says that the sequence is separated with semicolons and the initiator for each element is specified there. As a string telling it what those initiators or tags are. And these things that are describing the format are what are called DFDL properties. We use the term properties for them. Given that you've got a schema for your data, you can now parse it. You can take your data at the top there and you can put it through a DFDL implementation, parse it, and you get an infoset, which is a tree-like structure that represents the data that is easily projected to and from XML or JSON or other things. Those are very easy converters to write if you want to convert. You can also go the other direction. You can take an infoset as JSON or XML, and you can, well, we use the term unparse to invert that process and get back to the original data. I know some people are taking pictures of things. These slides are all on the schedule. So I only fixed typos since yesterday. So you're welcome to, we'll post the corrected ones eventually also as well. So you don't scribble if you, or photograph unless you really want to. So there's a lot of DFDL properties, and I'm not even going to pretend you can read this. I just wanted to show you that there's a big enough set here to be in some way comprehensive. It's quite a large set of properties for describing formats. So you can write a schema to describe your data, as we did in that little example, but you can also get DFDL schemas. And there are some DFDL schemas out there. The first category at the top there are things that are publicly available on GitHub. Some of them are things that people might recognize, like PCAP, which is effectively an example that we put out there just to show people how to write schemas. MIL Standard 2045, that's a very interesting and complicated format that's a message header that's used with various kinds of messages as sort of like a standard header label that's put around things. There's some financial services oriented ones. NACHA is a credit card transaction format, as is ISO 8583. Some of these were contributions from our organization at Traces and other developers, other organizations, MITRE and various other places. IBM contributed a lot of these. I put up in red at the top there, ARINC 429, because that's you can find that on GitHub, and Roger Champagne did that. He's at ETS, which is literally here in Montreal, like right over there. I think it's literally like almost the next building over here. And that's an avionics-oriented communications format. So there's starting to be a good quorum of useful schemas out there on GitHub. In my own work for the Department of Defense, We've also created a bunch of schemas, us and others have created some schemas for some of the more challenging formats. I've highlighted Link16 there. That's a format that dates from the 1970s. It's in heavy use across Department of Defense of US and NATO allies. There are also some commercial licensable schemas that come with products from IBM, and that's actually a space that Trasys may actually move into of creating licensable schemas. Schemas can be quite big. Schemas for things like HL7 and things like that are complicated and need, in some sense, either a community or commercial support of some sort in some cases. I was going to mention that a lot of these things are binary formats, and a lot of people would rather use textual formats and things like that nowadays, of course. I don't think binary formats are going away anytime soon, and that's because even today, there's people building things that are using 5-bit packed characters for high-speed financial trading and all kinds of things like that. So things that I thought I would never see again that you find in old standards like Link16, like 5-bit characters, are in fact found in modern formats as well, surprisingly. I wanted to mention the two other DFDL implementations that, and then I'll go into a section of the talk about Daffodil, Apache Daffodil, the software. IBM built the first DFDL implementation, came out in November 2011. It's embeddable as a library. There's a C and Java version, includes a clip-based tooling. It's actually a pretty significant part of their data strategy going forward from what I see. It's a significant part of two very important product families that they have. There's also an implementation from the European Space Agency. They call it DFDL4S or DFDL for Space. That's an embeddable Java and C++ version of it. It's really small subset. One of the reasons we made DFDL the language subsettable so you can build an implementation that's conforming to DFDL even though it's a pretty small subset was to allow exactly things like this. It really only handles binary data of the kind that they're exchanging to and from their satellites. But it's quite interesting that they were able to do that and they're enthusiastic embracers of the DFDL standard. So I want to go and tell you about Daffodil, the software, the actual open source implementation of DFDL that we have in the incubator. Wrong direction. Okay, so here's the history of this piece of software. It started out at the University of Illinois NCSA. There's some other influential software that came out of there too. I can't remember what it's called. It was like 20, 30 years ago. Anyone know what that is? Apache? anyway, we're pleased to share that legacy with other pieces of core internet technology and so forth. So that's Project Daffodil started in 2009 there. It's written in Scala. I put this little red heart up there because I'm a big advocate of Scala for people who are have been interested in Scala. It is by far one of the best development tools I've used in many, many years. I find it incredibly productive. The thing I always tell people is the type system in Scala is so good that you can express your intent with it so clearly that once you've got it to compile, it usually just works the first time. It's mind-bogglingly good that way. So if you want to learn Scala, Daffodil's a good project to join because you'll have the perfect excuse to learn it. This was further developed by Trasys Technology under contract to US DOD and Canada DND funding. It was intended to be open source from the very start. Version 1 came out in 2015, March, which was parse only produced XML on the output. Version 2 came out about a year ago, parse and unparse, XML and JSON converters. And we also started right about that same time in the Apache incubator. Version 2.10 was the first Apache incubator release. That was last May, and version 2.20 just came out a few weeks ago. I want to avoid version confusion for a minute because I'm going to talk about versions of two different things here. One is the DFDL language. DFDL language spec is at version 1, and there's really only a version 1. The Daffodil software has a rolling set of versions. We're up to version 2.2.0 now, and we're starting to speculate about version 3. So generally, if I'm talking about the software, the numbers will have 2.2. They'll have two. They have three components. Daffodil Language is version one. Now, what is Daffodil? Like, if you download Daffodil, what do you get? What's in it? What is the thing? It's jar libraries, of course. It runs on JVM. It's got this compiler and runtime and utilities in it. It contains this thing called a TDML runner, which is a test framework that is part of it. It's basically usable as a command line interface. The command, you can parse data and get out XML or vice versa or JSON. It has a debugger, so you can actually sort of single step your way through a parse and watch it go. Or you can turn on the trace and get an enormous animation of what all the parser was doing. It does include Java and Scala APIs with documentation. You get to pick if you want XML out or JSON out or in for unparsing. Now, of course, you still have to get your DFDL schemas somewhere. So I already pointed out you can get them from GitHub. There are some more restricted access sites for the military formats. Or you can, of course, write them and share them. A little more detail on what it is internally inside of Daffodil, there's a compiler. The compiler compiles a DFDL schema into a set of runtime data structures that can then be interpreted very rapidly. And its other important role is issuing diagnostics back to the user about things they've done wrong in their schema that make the schema not meaningful. Things they're not doing right in the DFDL language. Along with the compiler, then, is the runtime. The runtime includes a number of components. It includes this path language, the expression language of DFDL, which we call dpath. It has both a compiler and runtime for that language. The compiler isn't part of the compiler there. It's part of the runtime because Breakpoint Debugger, you get to type those expressions, and it has to compile them on the fly and execute them for you in the debugger. So that compiler is a very little thing, but it lives in the runtime. The InfoSet implementation and the conversions to and from XML JSON are in the runtime. The largest part of the runtime is the parser primitives and the unparser primitives, which are essentially the target of the compiler. This lives on top of an IO library, and the IO library basically is a departure from the ordinary underlying Java IO layer because lots of things in the world of DFDL are bits-oriented, not byte-oriented, and we have bit ordering issues to deal with. There's some constraints on streaming there's lots of things that are mixtures of both binary data and textual data. There's lots of non-8-bit characters in the world, 5, 6, 7-bit characters. We allow for formats that require unbounded look ahead for backtracking and parsing. So the IO library is actually quite rich and interesting structure in itself. There is the command line interpreter I mentioned. There's this thing called a TDML runner, that's test and tutorial, but really test data markup language. This allows you to write a self-contained test with test data schema, expected result, all in one file, which is great for explaining a problem, illustrating a bug, or testing a feature. And there's a large body of tests written in that language. Now, all the light blue boxes, are they blue or green? Blue? Light blue boxes are thick code that's written in Scala. There's a little bit of code that implements the Java API layer so that you can use all of this stuff naturally from Java. And there's a large body of tests written in TDML, our own test language. Just to give you an idea, this is how big this piece of code is. This is 300,000 lines of stuff total. The Scala, the functional Scala code, is the 92,000-93,000 lines of code in the tan piece in the upper right here. The unit tests, also written in Scala, is another 33,000 lines of code. The TDML test is another 130,000 lines of code, approximately. And so for those who are, you know, always worried about maturity and would I be able to depend on this piece of code and so forth, the fact that over half of this is test-oriented might give you some reassurance that we take that seriously, those of us who have been contributing to it. And the other slices of the pie are the DFDL schemas. Now, those aren't, strictly speaking, part of the Apache code base. Those are in other places on the internet. but I wanted to count them here just to sort of show the overall body of stuff that's been created around Daffodil. And then there's some tiny little slices of the pie, which are the integrations, which I'll talk about next. So we have integrations of Daffodil into Spark. And also NiFi, Apache NiFi. And the third thing, your project here, of course, if you can, I'd love to be able to put lots of other projects on this slide the next time I show it, because if you can intake or export XML or JSON, then Daffodil is going to basically allow you to handle anything describable with a DFDL schema in short order. So I think there's lots and lots of things in the Apache world that can benefit from that capability, and these integrations are pretty easy to do. So there's a couple of non-Apache integrations that are worth mentioning. There is an engine that implements a language called XProc, which is an XML pipeline processing language called Calabash. It's out in the open source, and we have an integration of Daffodil into that, so you can include non-XML documents in your processing pipelines, or non-XML data in your processing pipelines that you write with XProc. Software AG is a software company, and they have a significant data integration product called Web Methods Integration Server, and they did a very quick implementation of a Daffodil integration into it, and works quite well. It was quite interesting when I heard about that. It was like they basically just did it and then told us about it. So we're very happy about that. All right, so now I want to delve into some technical coolness. So I'm going to go into technical details about one of the things that Daffodil does that is kind of interesting and goes beyond what other data integration tools have done with data in the past. I'm going to try and go quickly through this because I'm not going to try to get you to understand every aspect of it, but just try to convey that it's interesting what's going on there. So what's harder, parsing or unparsing? Everybody who studied computer science had to study parsing a little bit. Look ahead, state saving, backtracking, is it bounded look ahead or is it limited look ahead, etc. Unparsing seems simple in contrast, right? You walk a tree of the infoset writing everything out. But DFDL has computed elements. That's the innovation, one of the important innovations we put into it over prior generation format languages. So what does that mean for unparsing? Well, unparsing, everybody wants to do streaming nowadays, right? Of course, they want to be able to process an unbounded size piece of data in a finite memory footprint. So the idea is limited memory footprint, and the data is just being streamed, the infoset in the case of unparsing, is being streamed at the unparser, which is writing the stuff out in the native format. If you're familiar with XML processing, there's an XML API called SAX, where you parse an XML document and it calls you back. It says, here's the start of an element, here's the data, here's the start of the next element, here's the child element, et cetera. And you, the consumer, have to respond to those events. Well, for the unparsing, you're the thing being called back. Here's the start of the element, here's the data, et cetera. Now serialize it out, please. So you don't get to just take the infoset tree and traverse it and write everything out. You're getting the data incrementally. And so that means the infoset tree, if you need it to do the unparsing, is going to be built up as the events are arriving. And you can throw away parts of it when you don't need them anymore, but which you have to do in order to be able to keep the memory footprint small. So very common data idiom is what I call envelope and payload. The data payload is surrounded by an envelope of structure. The envelope is either before and after. Sometimes it's a trailer. Sometimes it's just a header before the data payload. But it's extremely common for the header to contain the length of the payload. Right? We see this all the time. Millions of data formats do this. So here's a little example of that. So I've got, this is drawn from IP packet kind of thing. You've got the packet header, and it's got some fields in it, seconds, microseconds. It's got these length fields in it, which I've put question marks on, because this is a piece of XML we're looking at here. This is an infoset. Those length fields aren't really logical data. They're artifacts of how you serialize this thing and store it as binary data and put it on a wire. Those lengths are derived from this data, however, down here in the Ethernet part of the packet. So you actually have to unparse this first, measure how long it is. Now you can unparse the stuff that has to come before that, right? So here's the schema for our little packet here. The packet header has got some fields in it, seconds, microseconds. Then it's got this field incl-len. That's the length field that we're going to need. If we were just trying to parse this data, all we would need down here is in the link layer down here, we'd have to say the length of this link layer comes from that field up there, that incl-len field. But we need to be able to write out this data too. So we have a property in Daffodil called output value calc that says this element gets computed at unparsed time. And the expression here, which is written in Daffodil's expression language, says go get the value length of this thing. And that is where the problem comes from, because, so I'm going to use this illustration for a second. The idea here is events are flowing into the unparser across the top. They arrive in the unparser, it builds up the tree it needs, and it writes out the unparsed native data here. And so that we've gotten the start of the packet, the start of the packet header, we got the seconds element, we got some number in decimal, here's that same data showing up here in hexadecimal for representing binary data. So the problem is we get the end of packet header, well, but the packet header had to contain that length, but I don't have any of that data yet. So what do I do? So I have to do suspensions and double buffering. I actually have to build a sort of suspension-like coroutine object and hold on to it and come back to it later after I have received all these other events and stored them in the tree and unparsed them and measured how big it is. So that red triangle over there, that's the suspension. I'm hanging it off the incl-len element there of the tree because that's the thing I can't compute yet. 5 minutes left, okay. And what I've done is I took the output stream here and I've split it. I've still got the one that I was working with before, which I've labeled direct stream here, but now I've got this buffered stream, which is attached on the end. And such time as I am able to compute that incl-len field, I'll be able to output it here and then follow it with the rest. So I start processing now. I finally get the events corresponding to all the link layer data. I build up the tree. I start unparsing stuff. But it's going to land in that buffered stream now. And I have to keep doing that until the length can finally be determined. And when it's determined, and it turns out to be, in this case, 1,004 bytes long, finally, now I can unwind all of this. I can evaluate the suspension, I can fill in the incl-len, and I can write the incl-len out to this thing, and then it all folds back together. I can now collapse the output streams, and poof, the infoset can go away. And now I'm writing out to a regular old output stream onto the next piece of data that I'm unparsing. I'm not expecting people to have followed all of that. I'm just trying to point out that unparsing in DFDL is quite complex. In my view, I've written a lot of the code of all the pieces of Daffodil. I think it was harder to do than the parser was, honestly. This does make DFDL more expressive than other format description languages. These computed value elements are very valuable. In particular, it eliminates the need for applications to have to know a lot about the data format they're writing out. I mean, if you imagine you didn't have the ability for the format to compute that, the application would have to know how to write all that stuff out and measure how big it is and include it in the header. At that point, you have no separation between the application and the format at all. So this really helps you to separate the whole issue of data format from the application that's using it. I'm going to, in the interest of staying within my time limit, skip over a couple little slides. And I was going to talk about what Daffodil didn't do, but I'm going to basically run down to sort of the conclusion. So at the beginning I said, look, we need DFDL because there's hundreds of these systems out there. But the software world is very different now. Imagine you were starting a software company. You said you're going to build the best ever data, whoosie what's it, whatever it is. Columnar, new columnar database, whatever it is. You don't have to solve this problem yourself anymore. You can just grab this and get started, right? And that's pretty important because people have to invest tremendous amount of time in just this data intake problem. And we have a language standard. We've got 300,000 lines of Apache licensed Daffodil you can just start with now. So I believe this is really, we can use this to eliminate this chaos of overinvestment in endless data format systems finally. And with that, to do that, I need collaborators on the Apache Daffodil project. We need to grow our community. Obviously, to graduate from incubator, you have to have committers from multiple organizations. Daffodil's written in Scala, as you see, so we are looking for Scala programmers. If you're interested in learning Scala, this is a great excuse to learn Scala. We're happy to help you do that. Of course, if you're interested in Daffodil schemas, you can find those in the GitHub schemas, Daffodil schemas community as well. Finally, I'm going to conclude by reminding you again about the gnarly data boff tonight at 7 o'clock. If you have some gnarly data that you would like us to attempt, you can try. Steve and I are here. You could try to stump the chumps if you want, if you've got something particularly gnarly, and see if you can win the prize. And that's it. Questions? And of course, I'm here all week. I'm here until Friday morning, so you can grab me anytime. And you're right. So the information comes off of for the JSON, the labeling of the things in JSON comes off of the XML schema, but there are a few different ways to do that. It's sort of like translating XML to JSON. There are a couple different ways to do that. We've picked one. It may not be the perfect one, in which case I would be not at all surprised if someone wants to put switches into that so that they can get different styles of JSON out, for example. Right, so this is a very interesting question. So people commonly approach the DFDL problem with, well, I need data in this format, and it starts out in that format, so doesn't DFDL bridge the gap for you? And the answer is no, you actually have two problems. You have the DFDL problem, describe what's coming in, and you have the map problem, how do I get from there to what I need? And DFDL really is only about one of those problems. The mapping of, you in DFDL, you've got to describe what it is, not what you want it to be, what it is. And then you have to map it. So there is, but fortunately, if you have data in JSON or XML or something like that, there are mapping technologies. You can use XSLT if you like XSLT or XQuery or things like that if you want to use XML technologies. But there really are sort of two problems there. Now, in some cases, it's close enough that you can get there directly in one hop. But in some cases, it's not. Other questions?
Is it possible to validate data using this?
Yes. So one of the things that you can do, and one of the important applications for DFDL is parsing and validating data, actually. So you can use XML schema, and there's a mode where the facet constraints and things that are expressed in the schema, you can turn on a switch, and Daffodil will check those as it parses the data. You can also express additional kinds of constraints in DFDL to check things that are more more complicated. I'm sorry? Business rule. Yeah, that's right. You could write assertions and things and insert them in the schema that will insist that, you know, certain things appear in pairs and that this value is never more than that value and so on. And that's an important, very important use case for this because in the cybersecurity world, rip the data, validate everything, put it back together. Now you at least you know something for sure about it. Okay, flag is being waved telling me to stop to make room for the next talk coming in. So I'm happy to take other questions offline.